Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us once again as we continue the drive down memory lane or the digging through the monster box of cards. I don't know which one sounds more like you're getting something done. Driving sounds a little more leisure. Digging sounds like work. Well, it's a little mix of both, actually, as we're pouring through the big old monster box of baseball cards tucked away in the back corner of the bedroom closet. And we're going through the 1991 sets, and this time around we're touching up on one of my favorite sets. I know some people don't like it, but I've always loved this set ever since the day it came out. It is 1991 Bowman, and our random pull card number 556, catcher Craig Biggio. That's right, catcher Craig Biggio, all-star catcher Craig Biggio. The first position he was an all-star in, he's better remembered for his time at second base. That's where he spent most of his career, but he did start his major league career as catcher. And he used his tools rather well, as he was able to become one of the best, if not the best, you could argue, Houston Astros. Played his entire career in Houston, ended up in Cooperstown a couple years ago, and despite some injuries, put up some really impressive numbers. And you have to wonder, had he not been injured about, 15, 16 years ago, had he had some healthy seasons there in the prime of his career, he could have put up some incredible numbers. Not that he didn't, but he really could have just blown away the competition, probably would have been a first ballot inductee, but still got in there anyway, and rightfully so, as he is one of the best middle infielders of the 1990s and early 2000s, and like I said, could arguably be the best Astro in club history, helping the club get to their only World Series appearance back in 2005 with the help of the other Killer Bees, Lance Berkman and Jeff Bagwell. We'll talk about him and his career and all the fun things that he did in Houston, delighting Houston fans with his play for many, many years. And we'll also talk about the 91 Bowman set, which, like I said, I've always enjoyed. I've always liked that set. I know some people don't like it, but if you're a fan of rookies, you've definitely fallen in love with this set, even if the value of the cards is not that high because it is an overproduced set. But I've always liked the look, I've liked the feel, I've liked the smell. It's always been one of my favorite sets, and looking forward to talking about that set in just a little bit. After we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and we're talking about a lot because I asked this question during our last podcast about 91 Leaf, but also we put out a tweet yesterday asking you about this question as well, and that is all about the first set of cards that you own, the first complete set. We wanted to know what was your first complete set, whether it was store-bought, you know, a factory set, or if it's one that you put together all by yourself. And as a refresher, my first set was a complete factory set. I received it in 1992 at Christmas. It was a 1992 top set, and I broke right into it because the top set in 1992, that was the first year they had the gold card, and I, of course, opened up the box to see what the eight gold cards were. You had the 792 card base set, and then you had the gold card. So I instantly knocked off probably about $10 worth of card value there. I don't recall what the eight cards were, but I think I still have them in the box. I never actually put them into sleeves. But that was my first set. I never collected factory sets. In fact, to this day, so now we're going on almost 25 years, I have never bought a complete factory set. That may change. You know, my collecting habits have changed over the last few years as I've gotten back into the hobby. But that's the only one I have that was factory sealed and delivered to me on Christmas morning, 1992. Now, I've put together some sets, 87 tops for one. I'm still trying to complete 87, 90, and 91. And by the way, I've gotten some offers to complete the set from a few of our listeners. So thank you. I may be reaching out to you with a list of singles to finally complete those sets that I, you know, put away in boxes probably about 10 or 12 years ago. So eventually I'll get around to it. And in no particular order, we will start off with Ben Adams here, 1988 Donruss. And that's a bit of a surprise for a lot of collectors. That's a set that a lot of collectors don't like, even though I personally don't think it gets its fair shake. It's actually a good-looking set. And Ben says that he got it for Christmas one year, probably another reason I'll always like that set. And much like the first set that you collected, or the first pack of cards that you got, for me it was 89 tops, much like that first set that you start collecting, you'll always be tied to that particular set. Even if it's not a popular one in the hobby, you'll always like it for those personal reasons. Tim Murray, Christmas 87, received 87 tops and tops traded from parents. 'Twas a glorious moment, I bet, as you got truly the complete set there, the 792 base set, 792 card base set, and also the 132 card traded set. So good for you. And of course, it's a classic set and a lot of great rookies and star cards in both of those. I actually purchased the 87 Topps traded set. So, you know what? In a way, I have bought some factory sets before. 87 Topps traded, the 91 Donruss rookies. Those are the only two that come to mind. But in terms of like a full base card set, 92 Topps is the only one I have. But 87 Topps is a good one to have, and especially when you complement it with the star-studded traded set as well. Mandy Newham Cobb, thanks for writing in, Mandy, and for listening. Really little kid, I split a 90 Topps box with my brother. Was coming off a collector high from a Ricky Henderson find from a vintage pack. Well, I'm assuming that it was your brother who found the Henderson pack, or it was you, but that's a good way to start collecting cards right there. Buy in with a sibling. Why not? And, you know, especially after you get that high of getting that first big card. Reminds me when I got that Cal Ripken Jr. 82 Donruss card. I think that's when I really started buying more and more vintage packs, and that was many, many years ago. That's probably about 25 years ago for me, too. So I know the feeling. You get that first big name card from an older pack, and you're like, I've got to do more of this. So good for you, Mandy. 90 Topps, too, as I mentioned in the 90 Topps podcast, which was just a couple episodes ago. One of my absolute favorites as well, even though it is a little tacky. Cardboard Clubhouse. I wasn't really a set collector, but I did get factory sets of 90 Fleer and 91 Donruss at a yard sale for $5 for the pair once. Now that's a bargain. Some good sets there. I've mentioned my love for 90 Fleer. I've always enjoyed that set. 91 Donruss, I've liked that set as well. And we'll talk about 91 Donruss in a few episodes from now. But even though 91 Donruss was just as tacky as 90 Topps, I like that set too. That was one of the first sets where, Donruss actually split the set into two series. That was the first year that they did that. And I remember buying a box of each series as it came out. And I probably had close to a complete set, but I'll never know because I got rid of those cards, or most of those cards. I still have a handful. But some interesting cards that you buy, not secondhand, but on the secondhand market there. So even though you didn't collect complete sets much when you were younger, at least you got some pretty good deals on the ones that you got. Jason Carter, 1986 Factory Topps Christmas present. Mom ordered it out of the JCPenney catalog. Yes. Oh, remember those days? And you have to be... you have to be in your late 30s or early 40s to really appreciate the department store catalog, or older, because, you know, certainly once the internet came around and more people did their shopping online, the department store catalog became less and less of a factor in kids' Christmas planning. Now, I've seen stores like Target and I think JCPenney, I think they still put out like a, 100, 150 page catalog every year. And that's really just for old time's sake, because if you're going to go shopping for something, just legitimately go shopping for something, you're going to go online, you're going to use the search window, and you'll find it there. But back in the day, and specifically, Jason, 1986, that JCPenney catalog, I'm just going to guess, was about 600 pages, and it had everything in it. But the only thing that most of us kids were concerned about was the toy section. And if memory serves correct, that was like the second or third to last section. You know, you got past all the furniture and all the bed sheets and the women's clothing and the men's tool sets and all that stuff. You went straight to the toy section, and the toy section in the 600 page catalog was maybe 10 or 12 pages. It wasn't that big, but it was chock full of everything. And you went back there with a marker and you circled everything that you want. I actually do this with my son now. You still get, even though you don't get the full department store catalog anymore, every now and then, like Target especially, they will send you kind of a toy wish list catalog. It's maybe like a 15 or 20 page, you know, flyer basically in the mail. And of course, you know, I got a 6-year-old kid. He'll just circle everything that's in there. But it's not like the good old days of the department store catalog where you get the 600-page catalog and you track down the toys section and you circle what you want. And that's very cool that you got the 86 top set as a Christmas present. You see a common theme here. A lot of people getting complete sets for Christmas gifts year after year. So that's very cool. Let's see. Tony L., my first full set was 82 tops and I hand-collated that sucker. We then bought all of the big three of the next year as factory. Well, good for you. Boy, you struck gold with 83, not just the big three sets of Topps, Fleer, and Donruss, but the big three rookies of Ryan Sandberg and Wade Boggs and Tony Gwynn. That had to be an adventure putting that together. So great story there, Tony. Thank you for sharing. Peter Steinberg, my parents didn't love me enough to buy me a factory set. This probably isn't the proper outlet. Sorry. Well, I would have to charge more if you wanted to tell me all the stories. Well, you know what? Some people, they weren't lucky enough to get that Christmas gift or go out and have somebody shop for it. But I'm glad that you're still in the hobby despite the lack of empathy for your hobby days as a child. Interesting story here from Robbie T86, also known as Booby Main. 83 tops ordered it out of the back of the Sporting News for $14 delivered. Got it. And it was missing this card. And he sends us a picture of Juan Eichelberger, a pitcher for the San Diego Padres. I remember Juan Eichelberger because there was a pretty famous error card of him. I think it was 82 Donruss. I forgot whose picture he got flip-flopped with, but you know, the card said Juan Eichelberger, but it was somebody else. I'm sure a Padres fan will correct me on that, but clearly it wasn't Juan Eichelberger, because the player that was pictured on Juan Eichelberger's card, first of all, was a lefty and Eichelberger was a righty, but also let's just say the other player was slightly more fairer skinned than Juan Eichelberger, and that made for a pretty legendary error card. Now, Robbie continues, I was 13, so I sent a letter back to the dealer telling him it was missing, and a couple of weeks later, I got the card in the mail. Well, good thing you found an honest dealer there, so that was very cool. Now, I remember, too, you know, talking about the department store catalogs, I remember the back of the magazines, too. You could buy those cards. Now, you mentioned Sporting News. I was an Eagle Scout, so I had the Boys Life Scouting Magazine. It came out monthly, still does, by the way. And I remember this was after the fact. You know, when I was actually in the Scouts, you know, conveniently around the same time I was collecting cards, late 80s and early 90s, I don't believe they actually had the ads in the back of the magazine selling baseball cards. They had ads promoting military schools, which is quite scary. But I found some older issues when my older brother started in Scouts, and also we had an archive in our troop. We had a lot of Boy Scout or Boys Life magazines from, I'd say, the early to mid 80s in our archive, and I would just thumb through them just to kind of look at them. And in the back, you had two or three different dealers or stores selling not only baseball card sets, but also hockey and football and basketball. And here I am in like 1992, looking in these magazines from 1983, 84, 85, 86. And just like you mentioned, Robbie, looking at, you know, the chance to get an 83 top set for $14 delivered. Or for my hockey friends, you know, 84, 85 for, what, $16 delivered. And that would only be, you know, Mario Lemieux's rookie year. And, you know, you're just bashing your head against the counter going, oh, I wish I could go back in time and actually just buy set after set of this. But wasn't the case there. But just like the department store catalogs, the ads in the back of the magazines, in your case, Sporting News, in my case, Boys Life, that brings back some memories as well. One other note from one of our listeners, and this is not involving the sets, but it comes from our buddy in Buffalo, Waxpack916, sends us a picture of a lot of boxes. Got a few factory sealed boxes here, 291 Upper Decks. One from, let me see what year is this, 93 Upper Deck Series 2, and then a 91 Tops, and I love 91 Tops. We'll talk about that set as well in a couple weeks. But he asked the question, what do you think this should help me survive Buffalo's upcoming winter? Yeah, that should at least get you through a few days. Plenty of cards and packs to rip through there. Although I did make the suggestion to get a few boxes of 90 Donruss and use them as kindling, because it does get a tad bit chilly up in Buffalo this time of year. And he says, thankfully, I do not own any 90 Donruss. That's a sentiment that's felt by a lot of people in the hobby. All right, a lot of great stories there. Thanks so much again for sharing via our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains. Make sure you share that Twitter feed with your friends, and also share them the great news that we have two podcasts a week. It comes out every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and on iTunes, and we certainly look forward to your interactions on Wax and Gum Stains. And it doesn't have to pertain to our podcast or even questions we ask within the podcast, or, you know, something you see in our Twitter feed that you're responding to. We're open 24/7. You want to share pictures of cards, you want to share stories, you're more than welcome to. And if it's an entertaining story or a neat picture, something that we feel that others should see, we'll share it here in our podcast twice a week. Also, a quick reminder, still looking for a sponsor for the program. We'd like to find that perfect product or service that we think lines up with our listeners real well and helps you with your business if you are the business owner. Again, we're not looking to flood this podcast with commercial messages. It's a good link between you and the collector and vice versa. There are some small production costs for this podcast, so anytime we can bring somebody in to help us alleviate some of those costs and, again, make that connection between you and the listener, we're certainly open to all ideas. I follow most everybody who follows the Wax and Gum Stains feed, so if you have a business or a product or service or know of somebody who does, who you think might want to link up with our listeners, then please direct message the Wax Ecstatic Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and we'll see if we can get something going. All right, let's take a look at 91 Bowman, one of my favorite sets for a number of reasons, and our random pull again, card number 556, Craig Biggio of the Houston Astros, and only the Houston Astros, drafted by the Houston Astros in 1987 in the first round, 22nd overall. So it's not like he was a first overall pick. Pretty good gem mined by the Houston Astros for a first-round pick. And even though he flirted with free agency a couple of times late in his career, he stayed with the Astros and delivered year in and year out for that club. He was just an outstanding ball player. And let's actually get into the career of Craig Biggio before we talk about the 91 Bowman set. Dual sports star in high school, in Kings Park, New York, at Kings Park High School. He played football and baseball, but really excelled in baseball. He actually started as an infielder, but when he went to Seton Hall, the club there needed a catcher, so they moved Biggio to catcher, and he excelled there. And, of course, that was the position he was playing when he was drafted by the Astros in 1987. Very fast track up to the major leagues, would make his debut in the summer of 1988. In fact, June 26th, 1988, just a little more than a year after he was drafted. And he would turn out to be an all-star catcher, becoming a regular in a young rebuilding effort in Houston in 1989, became an all-star in 1991. And everyone's like, hey, this guy is going to be the next stud catcher in the National League. Well, the Astros were on to something that is now very commonplace in Major League Baseball. If you have a star power-hitting catcher, 9 times out of 10, before that player turns 30, he's going to get moved to first base. And it's simply because of the wear and tear of playing the catcher position. Teams are afraid of losing that big bat, because you've got to think about just torn up knees. You've got to think about concussions, guys getting dislocated shoulders and home plate collisions, even though there's fewer home plate collisions now. And of course, numerous foul balls fouled off of the toes of these guys. I mean, catchers hardly have toenails anymore because they're just taking foul ball after foul ball off their feet. So, you know, clubs want to protect these assets, so they move them into first base, or if it's an American League team, they'll move them to the designated hitter position. And their days as a catcher, very rarely does it get past the age of 30. So they decided to move him to second base. It was not a very popular decision. Biggio just kind of went with it, even though he was an all-star at the catcher position in 91. So 1992, he moved to second base, and what do you know? He was an all-star at second base. And not only because of his offensive production, which did not suffer, of course, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, he could play left field, and as long as the Astros were still putting him in the right spot in the lineup, he would still deliver. But as it would turn out, within a few years, he became a solid defensive second baseman. He would become a Gold Glove winner, and not just once, you know, just this little shot in the dark chance that he wins a Gold Glove. He was actually consecutively four times won the Gold Glove Award from 1994 through 1997 at second base. So the gamble paid off not only for the Astros, as they were able to keep him in that position for a very long time, but also, obviously, for Biggio. Really, the only time that he suffered any kind of injury was not because of simple wear and tear of a catcher, but when he injured his knee during a double play routine in the middle of the 2000 season. And it took him a little while to kind of get back to normal after that. But, you know, that was more of just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, trying to, you know, create a double play at the age of 34, as opposed to just having shot knees by the time he was 30. So he turned out to be a very good second baseman. He also did spend a little time in the outfield early on in his career, but for the most part, best known as a second baseman above his career as a catcher. Career fielding percentage at second base, .984, at catcher, .989. And then those brief times that he was in the outfield, .980. So wherever you put this guy, dependable is the very least you can say about him. And he was also very dependable at the plate as well. Again, mentioned that he had that injury-shortened 2000 season before he got hurt. He was hitting .268, plugging along for a season average of about 20 home runs and 70-75 RBI. So that got cut short. But every other season, with the exception of the strike season as well in 1994, if you go from 1989 through 2007 when he retired, this guy would hit 140-plus games a season. Now, in 89, he only played in 134, but still, I mean, that's in the ballpark. It's just six games off. So here's a guy who played 90% of the season and very rarely dipped. Very rarely did he hit a lull either at the plate or on the field. In fact, in 2007, his final season, he's 41 years old. The Astros are going downhill because they're about to prepare for another rebuild, a massive rebuild to get to the successful level that they're at right now. He still appeared in 141 games, had 555 plate appearances, hit .251, had 10 home runs, 50 RBI, had a handful of stolen bases, certainly didn't have the wheels like he did earlier in his career, but this was a guy who could still get on base and wouldn't hurt you in the field either. In fact, he appeared in 114 games at second base, and his fielding percentage a little lower than his career numbers, .979, but still very, very dependable, even at the advanced age for a baseball player of 41 years old. So Craig Biggio is the model of consistency in the 1990s and early 2000s. A lot of other big stars had major injuries, or you had the steroid suspicion, or there were some guys that had three or four really good years, but then for whatever reason, they just didn't deliver the rest of their career. They were journeymen afterwards, or they were designated hitters. And I think that's another key thing here. This was before the Astros moved to the American League a few years ago. So even at 41, he was contributing, but not in this part-time designated hitter role. He was platooned a little bit at second base, but he still out of 141 games, played second base in 114 of them. So this guy, he kind of surprisingly goes under the radar because, of course, in the 90s, we're all caught up in the home run hitting, and we're looking at the big, gaudy numbers of Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco and Sammy Sosa and the rest of that bunch. But you could always count on Craig Biggio to get on base, to drive in runs, to prevent runs with some solid defense up the middle. And that's a big reason why the Astros not only got to the World Series in 2005, but why they were a consistent contender throughout much of the mid to late 90s. And as we discussed in a previous podcast, they made a lot of rather dubious trades in the early to mid-90s, and had they been able to keep on to two or three of some of the players that they traded away, most notably guys like Steve Finley, also Louis Gonzalez, Curt Schilling, of course. They, of course, acquired Randy Johnson in a trade. Had they kept King Caminiti in the mid-90s, of course, Caminiti had a whole lot of issues going on. But had they kept two or three of those names that they mentioned, perhaps the Astros would have a World Series championship in their history. Certainly, I would say, they would probably have a couple more appearances. Of course, they would have had to go up against the juggernaut Atlanta Braves back then to get to the World Series, but perhaps they would have had the right pieces in place to actually make that happen. So Craig Biggio, no surprise, a Hall of Famer. He made it on the third ballot with 82.7% of the vote in 2015. Came very close in his first two ballots. First ballot, 2013, 68.2%. 2014, just a killer, 74.8%. He was 0.2% off. It was a given he was going to get in 2015. And I love baseballreference.com, of course, is a great website regardless. But they have a feature on there called similarity scores. And I like using this as kind of a barometer as to how guys match up against players of a similar caliber. And especially when you're talking about, is somebody Hall of Fame worthy? You look at the 10 similar players and you see how many are Hall of Famers or how many will be Hall of Famers. And will you be able to base that and guess, can somebody get into the Hall of Fame? Well, Biggio's already there. But you look at the top 10 similar batters, and I'm going to read them from 1 through 10. Robin Yount, Derek Jeter, Joe Morgan, Paul Molitor, Roberto Alomar, Cal Ripken, Johnny Damon, Brooks Robinson, Lou Whitaker, George Brett. I would say there's no doubt. You may go, well, you know, he had Berkman and Bagwell, and, you know, they had some pretty good pitchers in the early 2000s, and, you know, he probably would have put up those gaudy numbers anyways. No, you know, he earned it quite literally on his own in many years. You know, the Astros were not very good, but he was consistently good. And 7 of those 10 players that I named, they're already in the Hall of Fame. Jeter's going to be in there. You can make a very good argument that Whitaker and Damon should be in there eventually. So, you know, if you had any doubts, and some people may have forgotten about the career of Craig Biggio because playing for Houston, even though Houston is a big market, the Astros were not at the top of the conversation for many, many years. In fact, they really didn't get there until 2005, when they got to the World Series and everybody had to talk about them. And of course, by then, Biggio, as well as Bagwell in particular, had had very lengthy careers with the Astros, and you didn't really need to defend their careers. I mean, they just did outstanding from the moment that they put on that Astros uni. And when you look at this 91 Bowman card, again, card number 556, you've got the old batting practice jersey from the Astros from 1991, as this picture was likely taken. It looks like spring training 1991. And Biggio looks like he's about 12 years old here. He's kind of got a great kazoo batting helmet here. It's kind of funny seeing that. But, yeah, I mean, you could see this is a guy that just loves playing the game. I mean, he's got this great kid-like smile on here as he's just kind of, you know, hanging around. It's almost like hanging around the batting cage here. And the 91 Bowman set, I've always liked it, even when it came out. Some people don't like the design, the front of the card here. But let's go back through 89 and 90 real quickly. I said that the 90 Bowman set was kind of, I think, what Bowman wanted to do in 89. Have a very simple, unique card, a little plain, but very simple. And, you know, the problem with the 89 set, of course, is the cards were way too big. They were larger than the normal card size. So when they dropped it down to 90, I said that the 90 set was kind of what they wanted in 89. Well, 91 was kicking it up a notch. A very, very simple design here. You've got the white border all around. You've got the inner border, which is gold on the outside, blue on the inside. At the bottom, you've got the player name. In this case, Craig Biggio here on this kind of purplish pinkish bar. You've got a little notch cut into the bar. That's where the Bowman logo is. And you've got a full color photograph right up on the front of the card. And Bowman photography, you know, they had some action shots in 91, but really they used the 91 set for a lot of casual stage shots. And when you compare it to Topps that year, of course, Bowman owned by Topps, Topps used a lot more action shots in their set, while Bowman was a lot more laid back. Also, one interesting thing about the Bowman set, if I recall correctly, this came out later than the other 1991 sets. Most of the time, the card sets would be released to the public in late February, early March, you know, when spring training was starting. And I believe Bowman didn't come out until early May, I want to say. And what was unique about that is, you know, in the day and age before the computer technology allowed for card companies to basically Photoshop new jerseys or logos, well, by having a late spring release, Bowman was able to get some of the spring training cards, you know, pictures of guys in spring training, which certainly helped their rookie collection. We'll talk about that in a moment. But also, it helped showcase guys in their new jerseys. And in fact, if you look at the Bowman box from 1991, Fred McGriff in a Padres uniform is prominently featured on the top of the box. And of course, that was a huge trade for both San Diego and Toronto, with McGriff and Tony Fernandez going to San Diego, Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar going to Toronto. That set up the Blue Jays' two World Series championships in 1992 and 93. So, you know, as a Blue Jays fan, it was kind of odd seeing Fred McGriff wearing, you know, the new Padres uniform. And that was the other thing. You know, the Padres, for the first time in their history, ditched the brown. They had the blue and orange pinstripe look that they introduced in the 1991 season. Well, this was the first set to showcase it because it was released a little later. So they got a whole bunch of pictures from spring training, and they were able to release these pictures. And you got to see, again, pre-internet days, you know, totally different back in 1991, you got to see not only the new players with their new teams, but also new uniforms, new logos, and stuff like that. So that was one of the neat things about the slightly later release of the Bowman set. Also, it was a huge set. 704 cards, I believe, was the final count there, which was very unusual. When the 89 Bowman set came out, it was just under 500 cards. 90 Bowman, they increased the set size. But then, you know, come 91, they got into 704 cards. So it was a pretty massive set to collect. Now, the back of the cards, I've always liked these. I've said before with 89 and 90 Bowman, I loved the team-by-team breakdown, which was a lot easier to do then because there was no interleague play, so you could just break it down either National League or American League, depending on which league the player played in. But, you know, this was, again, ahead of the curve in the sense that this was splits. This was kind of advanced stats back in the day, and it was completely different from what others were doing. And I've always liked how Bowman has done this, even though a lot of collectors don't. But I've liked how they've done this, and I've loved the back, the color of the back of the cards, as you have the gray cardstock, so you have this kind of tannish gray primary color, but this unique combination of dark green, kind of this Kelly green or an emerald green, and black. And even though it's somewhat similar to the 82 Topps back, which I never liked because that was kind of green and purple, the green and black actually work very, very well. So you combine the unique back, not only in look and feel with the game splits, but you also have the very simple and clean and just very, very basic but good-looking front to the card. And this has always been a winner in my mind. Now, again, I know a lot of people, they don't like the design of the front of the card. They think it's too boring. They don't like the back of the card. I'm talking to you, baseball card backs. You don't like the back of the card because it's confusing. It's different. You don't like it. but I've always liked the slightly unique, and again, in pre-internet days, cards had to present stats differently. They had to present players differently because this was the main medium that a lot of baseball fans learned about their players, you know, unless you had a, you know, a subscription to, you know, the Sporting News or Sports Illustrated or a baseball publication. This is how you knew the players. And I always liked when card companies would take a slightly different view of players and teams. And this was definitely a very, very different look. And I've always liked it. Now, another thing that I've liked about 91 Bowman, and if you collected back in the day, you will understand this. I've said before, and it's been a while since I've said this, so if you're new to the podcast, let me explain. If you buy baseball cards from 1991 or earlier, and in particular, Topps or Bowman cards, you have the bubblegum in there. Now, the bubblegum was a curse in many ways for a couple of reasons. One, because often it was hard as a rock. If you didn't get a pack that was freshly released, you know, if you bought a pack in March or April, the gum was still kind of sort of fresh. After that, it was just crumbling in your mouth. So the gum was hard. It was disgusting. But also it stained the cards. Hence the Twitter feed, wax and gum stains. We can laugh at it now, but back in the day when you opened up that pack and that star card had the big, bumpy, dark gum stain on it, you hated it. Well, if you buy a pack of those cards, and you can still do this, buy any pack of 88 Tops, you know, 90 Bowman, whatever, you know, don't spend too much money. But buy a pack of these cards, open it up, and before you go searching through the cards to see what you got, smell them. I know this is very, very strange here, but smell the cards. Take a deep breath. Just go. You will smell the most intoxicating, in a good way, the most intoxicating, inviting mix of bubblegum, wax, and cardboard. I love that smell. And even though Bowman was wrapped in cellophane wrappers, which was certainly different from years past. In fact, 91 was the first year that Topps switched over from wax to cellophane, and they would do the same with the Topps brand. Even though they were wrapped in cellophane, you still had that cardboard and gum smell. And I love that smell. And if there was a way, and I think Topps actually does this with some of their heritage cards, if there's a way you could just recreate that smell and just dab it on new cards, I'd love new cards even more just because, you know, like I said, it's not like a perfume smell. It's not a sexy smell, but it is the smell that instantly takes you back to your childhood when you were collecting these cards. And it's just like the smell of fresh baked chocolate chip cookies. You can travel back instantly, 30, 40 years, however old you are. You go back to those days when you went to grandma's for the holidays. It's the exact same thing. You open up a pack of these cards from, let's just say, 1987. You're transported back to 1987 so quickly just because of the smell, never mind the actual card itself. So I've always liked 91 Bowman for the look, the feel, and yes, the smell. As strange as it sounds, a little embarrassing to say that, but if I have, and the smell stays, by the way, with these cards for years, you know, these are 25-year-old cards, but you could still pick up a stack of 91 Bowmans, put your nose right up to it, and you could still smell that smell. It's an intoxicating smell. Trust me, try it. Like I said, get a pack of, you know, something cheap, you know, 88 Tops, 90 Bowman, you know, 86 Tops, maybe you've got some extras laying around, and just take a big whiff. You'll see what I'm getting at here. So I've always liked the 91 Bowman set, and I think it was really a turning point in the Bowman history. We mentioned this during the 90 Bowman podcast. 90 Bowman was where more and more rookies got dropped into the set. Well, 91 was definitely the year that Bowman became the set of rookie card collectors. Some of the bigger names: Chipper Jones, Jeff Bagwell, Jim Tomei, Ivan Rodriguez, also, let's just call them B-list rookie cards here, Kenny Lofton, Raul Mondesi, Tim Salmon. There were plenty of other young stars that were included in this set. You also had a very interesting foil MVP set. You had a five-card Rod Carew set, not really a subset. It was more of a tribute. And again, pre-internet days, this is how I learned about Rod Carew. There was also, I remember, a card dedicated to Jimmy Rogers, who had spent 75 years in professional baseball. He was like 91 or 92 years old. He was kind of a clubhouse attendant for the California Angels. So kind of a neat thing there. So a very unique collection of cards. You know, the Carew card, the MVP cards. There was one also for the shot heard around the world, because, of course, 1991, that was the 40th anniversary of Robbie Thompson helping the Giants win the pennant with that home run off Ralph Branca. The late Ralph Branca, recently passed away, Ralph Branca, in the Polo Grounds in 1951. There was a card for General Colin Powell, too. Remember, this is shortly after the end of the first Gulf War. So you had a really unique group of cards here. And again, with that unique look, that unique feel and smell, it's really a great set. Now, much like most other sets from 1991, overproduction, so even big name rookies like Chipper Jones, I mean, ungraded, you can find them for $4 or less. Actually, I've seen graded Chipper Jones cards going for like $20. So, again, this is not a set that you want to collect because you're looking to make a mint off of it. But with that said, this is one of the few sets from around this era where you can buy them in bulk now. There's still plenty out there. You can collect those rookie cards, or you can make a complete set out of it. And this is one of those sets that will, I won't say will rise in value, but will have some value. I think it will maintain its value for a few years down the line, because a lot of those rookies, of course, are Hall of Famers. And if it's not rookies, then it's, you know, some of the younger guys like Craig Biggio or Ken Griffey Jr. or, I mean, you name it, you know, John Smoltz, Tom Glavine, Greg Maddux. You've got all those guys in here. And you could certainly make a case that, okay, I may spend $20 or $25 to put this together, and maybe in a few years it's worth $35. This is definitely a bond-type purchase, not a stock market purchase. This is a bond purchase. You're not going to get rich quick by any stretch of the imagination. But I do suggest that if you want to collect a nice set that's got some great rookie power, some great star cards, and again, I like the look. Not everybody does. But I like the look to this set. It's a worthy investment. I would actually look into it. Now, because the 91 Bowman set is full of all kinds of rookies and you know, is somewhat popular with some collectors, the boxes are a little pricier than some of the other sets from this time. You know, I've mentioned some of the previous podcasts, some of the cards we've talked about. You can get cards or you can get boxes for $10 each, or sometimes like 3 for $12. I mean, something ridiculous like that. I've seen most 91 Bowman boxes around $20. That's kind of the base price, not including shipping, but that's pretty much it. And of course, the Chipper Jones rookie, the big reason for that. And sets I've seen for about $30, which is a few dollars more than what you would normally see for sets from this time. So there is a little more value in a 91 Bowman set as opposed to, say, 91 Fleer or you know, certainly like 90 Donruss, 90 Tops, you know, other sets from around that time. There is a little more value to it. Now, Bowman would continue on the rookie bend for a long time afterwards, still is pretty much the set of the rookie card, but also in 1992, the quality of the card received a major upgrade. You had glossiness added to the pictures. You had some more rookie cards added to the mix, and Bowman would be reduced in production. Topps actually pulled back a little bit in 92, so there is some value to the 92 Bowman, and certainly 93 Bowman as well, as you had guys like Mike Piazza come along, also Mariano Rivera. So the value of those cards, much, much more than 91. But the 91 Bowman set, very affordable, easy to get, and I personally recommend it. Give it a second look. Give it a try. You know, go on eBay, pick up a couple boxes, and and see what you get out of it. If you don't get a complete set, at least you're going to have a stack of some really good young star players out of your wax packs, or cello packs, I guess I should say, considering they were wrapped in cellophane and not wax back then. All right, so there's our look at 91 Bowman. Craig Biggio, our random pull as well, card number 556. You're more than welcome to talk about that set, that player, or anything. Again, we're open 24/7 on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, the official Wax Ecstatic Twitter feed. Now we are going to take a look at 91 Score in our next podcast. That's another interesting set, and it's interesting because it's tacky in a lot of ways, but also very unique, and you've got some pretty interesting photos in that set as well. So we'll do a random pull. We'll take a look at 91 Score, which, unlike 89 Score, which was a disaster, kind of built off the success of 90 Score. So we'll take a look at that in our next podcast, which will be coming your way on Tuesday. I'm Matt Salmon, your host of the Wax Ecstatic Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And again, Tuesday, we got a brand new edition of Wax Ecstatic coming your way.